Welcome to the Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 111, episode 111 of the Flux Capacitor. A bit of a different format for this episode. It's stripped down, no cold open, a short intro and close, so we can get it up and online quickly. This will, I hope, prove to be timely because we're talking about the Canadian federal election through an electricity lens. And we're recording this at 6 o'clock in the morning Eastern, 3 a.m. on the West Coast, the morning after Canadians went to the polls. On the pod today is as close to a regular as there is, going all the way back to the very first episode. He's been a commentator, a guest, and a substitute host. Electricity Canada VP of Government Relations, Michael Powell, joins me for a hot take on the election. Michael, welcome back to the Flux Capacitor.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. This morning, it's indeed.
As you know, Francis, it's super early in the morning. We've both been freebasing on election podcasts that started this early over the course of the last 36 days or 37 days. So it's nice to get to do that myself, sort of. But yeah, so it's what a night.
What a night, indeed. And as we start the morning, it looks like what we're going to be facing is a minority parliament. It looks, with the exception of a couple of seats on the margins with the Bloc Québécois, the NDP, and a Green Party seat, it looks an awful lot like a two-party result. What's your initial take on just overall the results that we're seeing? And maybe what was your evening like last night, Michael? Were you at a watch party?
I was at a watch party. I was at a friend's house, so it was just two of us, and wine was open as is required. There was snacks, and it was a roller coaster. So, as we think about what watching an election like this is like, there's a lot of waiting at the beginning, and so with the first polls closing in Eastern time at 7, though 7:30 for the real results in Atlantic Canada, there's really 2 hours where all you have to look at is very early results from a handful of ridings. And early on, it looked like the Conservatives were making breakthroughs in places where perhaps they weren't expected. And so Nova Scotia, as an example, and parts of Newfoundland, relatively safe seats fell to the Conservatives. And it looked like perhaps this would be very different than as we expected. But as the night went on, and as more polls opened, or closed, I should say, we could, you stopped paying attention to Nova Scotia stuff, and it sort of ended up where it was. And as the night progressed, we got into a pretty unconventional situation where it looked like either of the two parties, the Liberals or the Conservatives, might be able to, band together and pass legislation as they see fit. In the end, of course, we have what looks like a pretty comfortable Liberal lead with just four seats shy of a majority and a couple of ways of getting there. So the most likely would be by passing, having the NDP vote with them, but also the Bloc. And of course, in theory, the Conservatives could, band together with the Liberals on stuff to happen. The interesting thing when I think about the House of Commons in this is that it's not just voting on bills that matters. It's how do you get stuff through committee? And one of the ways that made the last parliament relatively stable right up until September, because of the Liberal NDP confidence and supply arrangement, is that the Liberals, with working with the NDP, were able to agree to move stuff from committee. As it's structured right now, I think, we'll see how it gets sorted, is that the Liberals would need the Bloc Québécois to have stuff get out of committee. And so that means that there will be one Bloc MP, most likely, at each and every committee, whose vote will be needed to move legislation from the committee floor, committee table, to the House of Commons floor, and then be passed accordingly. And that can lead to, all sorts of challenges moving legislation through and having control of it before it gets to the House of Commons.
Right. Yeah. So, looking at the numbers, again, the numbers as they are at this particular point in time, And I guess you understand the complexities a little better than I do. I'd look at it and say, liberals probably at 168, they need 172 for a majority, but there's seven NDP. But I guess what you're saying is there's some complexity here because the NDP would not have official party status, right? Is
That's
that the
right. And so on
gotcha.
the surface, I don't think that they get, and I looked in the I got up early enough, Francis, to look at the parliamentary procedures, and it's recognized parties that get committee seats. Sorry, we'll see. Either way, even if the NDP gets a seat here and there, there will be a situation where they don't. The Liberals are still looking for, that one extra vote at committee to get stuff through. So that means your budget bills, your big bills to change permitting, to pass trade laws, as an example. Imagine a situation where you get a new deal on trade with pick a country, maybe America, perhaps the EU or UK, and there's literally the word dairy in there, and that would be a complication for the Bloc Québécois to support or not support if it comes anywhere close to something changing supply management, even in the smallest way. And so that part of the legislative process will be interesting. Of course, the government process, there is no such thing as a minority government. The powers that ministers have will be just as they are, and the Liberals can wield them accordingly.
Okay, well now that's something I didn't hear last night in from any of the commentators when looking at the numbers, but the ability to get through things through committee it certainly looks like it would be a little more challenging as a result of that. Okay, well listen, Michael, let's talk a little bit about the campaign and what worked and what seemed to work and what didn't work. Any kind of overall observations there?
Well, the story of this will be the collapse of the NDP, and to a certain extent, the Bloc Québécois, who have both lost seats, the NDP a substantial number of seats. And the NDP had, the better part of 20% of the vote in the last two elections. And then last evening, looking at the CBC poll tracker, they're in and around 6.3% of the vote. So that yields seven seats right now. Maybe it'll be more, maybe it'll be less, but not, but certainly not going to be an official party. And most of that vote seems to have gone to the Liberals. And in places like Atlantic Canada, it meant that there are Liberals kept seats even as the Conservative vote increased. The Bloc Québécois collapse or decline, or the NDP collapse in Quebec and shift of the Bloc to the Liberals has produced an increase in the number of seats. And then in Western Canada, you've seen an increase in Liberal seats. So in Manitoba and even in Saskatchewan, there's now big rural red ridings that are there, which previously had been blue or orange, as the case may be. And that's, because of a shift in the vote. I think what's interesting, though, where honestly I've not had the time to dig in, is that in Ontario, the situation was very different. And so And when we've gone through the polls and the deepening parts of the numbers over the course of the last several weeks, the interesting thing is the dominant issue for most people, as identified, particularly for Liberal voters, is our relationship with the United States. But for others, there's affordability issues, there's crime issues, there's pick one that 10 years in, people are getting their views on this government may have changed. And so what we've seen is ridings where we thought that Ontario would be a relatively big lead for the Liberals. It ended up being much closer than we thought. And in 905 ridings, there were some flips, that there were places where the Liberals lost seats that perhaps they would have won previously. So, as an example, in the Greater Toronto Area, in York Centre, Liberal Yara Sachs lost to Conservative Roman Bobber, who previously had been an MPP, but comfortably flipped there in Vaughan. Longtime Liberal Francesco Sorbara, who had eked through the last couple of elections, lost pretty handily to a Conservative with 60% of the vote to just about 40. And so those are the sorts of bellwether ridings that in normal times would indicate a path towards a conservative government. One pollster that used to work for the Liberals pointed out that in some ridings, particularly those with large Asian Canadian communities, or just sort of the new Canadian communities in the 905 area, you saw a shift towards the conservatives, which would mean that some of the stuff that they were talking about landed, and that big ground game, that 2 years of work had hit somewhere. In contrast, it looks like Pierre Poilievre lost a seat last night. So there's a bunch of focused areas where there was a lot of work by a lot of liberals in Eastern Ontario, where I think the Trump stuff lands a bit different, has hit, and in other areas where perhaps bigger considerations are happening, be they affordability or crime or you name it, the conservatives did pretty well. And so if it wasn't for that NDP collapse, like Ontario would have shifted this to that got them seats in Quebec, we'd have a very different night where it looks like the conservatives, would be much closer, if not in the seat of government.
So what you hinted at there was what felt like kind of dueling narratives as to what the ballot question was. The suggestion that for some people it was about the Canada-US relationship, for other people it was about affordability. What's your take on that dueling narrative? Is that really kind of why we sort of see a pretty clear split in the kind of in the ridings in the electorate? It's around 40-odd% for the 45 to the low 40s. Is that a reflection of those different views in terms of what the ballot question was?
I think so. I think, no one goes to the polls and says, "What is the ballot question that I'm answering?" But in your gut, you have the kind of thing that you're focused on. And in some places, some parts of that question are going to be more important than other things. And so I don't think anyone's not concerned about a relationship with America, but maybe you are more focused on things that are like, if you have a hard time finding a house, Mark Carney being stronger negotiating with Donald Trump as an idea versus Pierre Poilievre is probably not going to be the defining factor. And also, like, maybe you were just more interested in some of the solutions we've heard elsewhere. But there's been a lot of work by Team Poilievre over the last few years to really define the kinds of things that have to happen and then make the solution be them and not a different version of a liberal leader, which obviously was enough of a change for a lot of folk, because let's remember, like, if we had this conversation in late December, the idea that the Liberals would be 4 seats shy of a majority with the highest vote count they've had since 2000, would like it would not be this kind of serious conversation we're having, and instead it looked like we were all reading the various polling websites, which made it sound like Mark Carney could get 200 seats, and in the end we have a pretty close choice between in a country where there's a split on this sort of thing, more or less right down the middle, and regionally leading to a divided government or a divided parliament, which I think reflects what the mood of the people is.
So let's talk a little bit about that shift in public opinion, because both you and I have spent the last, I don't know, 18 months at least, listening to pollsters talk about that huge gap and the massive lead that the Conservative Party had right up until the election writ. I recall last year, Michael, we brought in pollsters into some of our meetings to present to the membership, who were talking about it would be near impossible because the Conservatives were so far ahead, the Liberals were so far behind, for that to turn around. Was it just a matter of Trudeau, or was it just a matter of Donald Trump? Is it a combination of some of those things? And what do we make of basically almost 2 years of pollsters telling us that there's no way that this can turn around, and it turned on a dime?
Well, I guess the lesson is nothing ever happens until it does. And I think the future will be, instead of us going around and saying, none of this can possibly happen, to just saying something along the lines of, well, unless we get a Donald Trump, we're never going to see a change like this again. And I don't think I've been thinking a lot about this because, it's my job and your job to provide advice to members on what we think might happen and sort of inform our strategy and our actions and our thoughts around it. I don't think we made any wrong choices. But I do think that what it shows is that there are some consequential choices that face Canada that come up and that can override these things. And so it's not like the folks that were concerned about affordability that, maybe had the Canada-US conversation be a more prominent part of their choice have forgotten about affordability. It's just that there's a bigger thing that's in front of them. We kind of saw that during COVID as well, that who can get us through the pandemic was a very key thing for some of the early provincial elections. And as you got, a little farther along, when we saw our last federal election, where things were more at a stable state, then the conversation changed a little bit. I think the Trudeau factor's there as well, that the willingness to consider the Liberals as the interlocutor for these sorts of national conversations was a lot harder when you had a very unpopular leader at the front who was divisive in the sense that some people just really didn't like him no matter what. He could probably maybe he could have solved this whole Trump thing and people still would have disliked him for whatever reason over the last 10 years. And it's hard to say that we're having that change conversation without a shift at the top. And so Mr. Carney is, of course, a different person and different in tone in a lot of ways. But a lot of the core stuff that the party ran on, so some form of carbon pricing, a commitment to continuing on some direction of addressing climate issues, but on a growth focused way, are still there. And just as like if you were to compare platforms between the Liberals and the Conservatives on a bunch of things, building projects faster, focusing on growth, there's tax cuts on both sides, there's some similarities. And so that gets that. I don't know. Like we're a lot of there's going to be a lot of PhDs written on the last 2 months, 4 months. And my sense is that it was the Trump effect on these pieces because it changes how people think about themselves and what it means for us and what we need right now in Canada. And then the second part would be a change in the Liberal leadership with a candidate that I think a lot of people saw as being a steady hand in these sorts of things. But just a change that it allowed people to consider voting Liberal again, when, 4 months ago or 5 months ago, that would not have been on the table.
Yeah. So, hey, let's talk about that Trump effect. How big a shadow did it cast on the campaign?
I mean, I think that the shadow had almost no light. I feel like certainly the first 2 weeks of the campaign were defined by it. I mean, in the middle of the campaign, we had the risk of existential tariffs being applied in the quote unquote Liberation Day, April 2nd tariffs, which ended up being a little all over the place. And perhaps Canada may have avoided the worst of, but over the campaign, we saw 25% auto tariffs added. In the last 4 days, the president started talking about Canada as a 51st state again, and it would seem that it was always right around the corner. And I think that it's hard to imagine a conversation that doesn't include that with what does the next few years look like as we rethink what our government looks like. The interesting thing was, and this was a focus of the Liberal campaign, obviously it played to their strengths. A criticism of the Conservative campaign was they didn't talk about it enough. And there were a lot of blue on blue Conservative warfare over the last week, as it looked like they were going to have a worse night than perhaps they did, that they weren't talking about the tariffs and Trump enough. Doug Ford was on in the news yesterday saying, why aren't we talking, why aren't they talking about tariffs, basically was the key point. And clearly that wasn't where a lot of people's votes were and where the conservatives were strong. It was probably on stuff beyond tariffs, and that's what got people out to vote for them, because the areas where they are strongest were on those sort of affordability and crime issues, and that's where they focused, and that's where they got their seats. Wasn't enough to flip to, them be having the most seats necessarily, but it was, they have more votes and they have more seats than they did tonight, before Parliament dissolved.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm just looking at the comparison from 2021 to 2025. The Liberals jump 8 seats from 160 to 168. The Conservatives jump from 119 to 144. So it is quite a shift. But listen, speaking of the Trump effect, I think we'd be remiss, given that our podcast is about electricity, if we didn't take a minute or two to talk also about the shadow that it casts on the electricity sector. Both you and I have spent a significant amount of time the first 4 months of this year both talking about cross-border issues and spending time in Washington, D.C. What's the for the listener, what's the kind of the state of play right now for electricity as we look at the various announcements that have been made with respect to cross-border trade and tariffs?
Yeah, so a lot of our focus has been on figuring out whether electricity was a tariff good or not. And so
Right.
for 4 months, the first few months, we were trying to, well, A, not get included, and then B, figure out if we were going to be included. And then, I think there was 12 or 13 hours where maybe we were tariffed and we weren't sure at what rate. And then ultimately right now, today on April 29th at 6:40 a.m., there is no tariff on electricity trade between Canada and the United States. And that's the mechanism of that is because on all of the various tariffs that on the general tariffs anyway, between Canada and the United States that the president has put on, there is an exemption for goods that are covered under the Canada-US Mexico agreement, the new NAFTA, and so electricity's in there, so we're exempt. Should that change, on a lot of areas, there's sort of energy exemptions. For electricity, that's tough. That's important. It's tough to tariff us. It's never been done before. You don't have electricity trucks that roll up to the border where you can count all the electrons and then put a waybill on them and then assign someone a bill. And so it's, our system has not been designed to allow for that. And really, on a practical basis, as you move goods back and forth, it's, you can't really do it. So we're very comfortable with that. I think the big thing, though, that this is focused is that it's, raised a conversation about what should the Canada-US electricity relationship look like. And I don't think anyone's suggesting that the integrated grid is not important, but it's really changed the conversation in Canada about what does east-west interconnectivity look like, and what obligation should we be committing ourselves to on some of these pieces. Manitoba, as an example, in the last few weeks, a long-term export contract ended, and it wasn't renewed. And the premier made, a show of it. Part of that could be for other things, including making sure that you have, capacity domestically. But it's not for nothing that, that contract wasn't renewed, but a commitment to provide power to Nunavut, albeit a lot less, came at the same time. So that's where we are. We're trying to figure out and navigate what it means for goods and supply chains. Obviously, there's a lot of steel and aluminum that goes into electricity products. There's a lot of stuff from overseas, including China, that goes into electricity products. So what does that mean as we look to
So,
expand the system?
when you say electricity products, you mean the
Oh,
equipment
I mean
used
like the
to
equipment.
generate
Sorry. Yes,
transmit?
yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So like poles and transformers and meters and
Meters, exactly.
all of the equipment. Yeah. Okay.
So we don't know what that's going to look like,
Yeah.
and we also don't know what the economy in Canada is going to look like. What does a long-term trade war look like for Canada and the United States? What does a decline, a slowing of the American economy look like for an export-dependent country like Canada? Even if we have perfect access to an American market, is if it's smaller, what does that mean for production here? And what does that mean for the use of electricity and demand for electricity. So there's a lot of questions on that front. The big and immediate one for us might be answered, but the sort of zone of uncertainty as we move forward is, I still think, quite large.
Okay, let's get back to the election. We are going to be looking at a likely a liberal minority government. What did the liberals say about electricity and energy? So, what should we be expecting for the electricity sector when we look forward to the next parliamentary session?
Yeah, so I mean, the biggest thing for us is in our sector, there were some pieces that were committed to in the last parliament that didn't get finished. In terms of the supports that go towards electricity companies as they look to build the system, there were investment tax credits and for some electricity companies in 7 of 10 provinces, there was none for them yet. So the so-called clean electricity ITC needs to be passed, and we expect that it will get passed in an upcoming budget. And that we think we're pretty confident that, I mean, we're very the Carney team Carney was very clear that would happen. And there's some pretty good signals even from the Poilievre team on that end as well. But looking forward, I think the big conversation will be on growth. What does it mean to build out Canada to make it more competitive at a time where we have to rethink where our economy is going? And what we've seen is the Liberals talk a lot about sorry, my alarm is telling me that I have to get up. The biggest thing is on permitting to build big projects, projects of national significance, do it faster, do it in a clearer timeline. And then focusing on stuff that is also tying the country together, including an east-west electricity grid. So there is a specific commitment from the Liberals to build out Canada's east-west electricity grid. They're calling it a nation-building transmission project. They've committed $500 million over the next 4 years each year to doing so. They're talking about investing in our energy potential, including clean energy, which is usually what they mean by that is electricity, and then and making sure that the pathway to build these projects is there. So we talked about the ITCs, but also working with Indigenous communities and expanding funding opportunities that they have access on to build into equity pieces. So there's a lot to come. There's a lot of commitments, and then the actually making these things happen will be a lot of our work over the course of the next 6 months to a year. How do we go from sometimes a very slow and laborious process to approving a big project to doing it in a timeline that is, pretty aggressive with a firm commitment from government to get that to happen? And what does it mean for our sector to live up to our end on these sorts of things? That if the government commits to a, 2 year approval timeline, what does that mean for what electricity companies need to do to be able to meet that?
So, you touched on investment tax credits. You touched on permitting. One of the other issues you and I and many members of our team have spent a lot of time on the last couple of years is on the clean electricity regulations. Were they kind of mute on the clean electricity regulations, or was anything said about CERs by the Liberals during the campaign?
No, I don't think. I mean, the Liberals did not say anything on this. It'll be an interesting conversation because I think what we've seen from this iteration of the Liberals is a willingness to be flexible on areas where there's concern on how you implement things. The most obvious of that is the carbon price, the consumer carbon price. The Prime Minister canceled in a big show is literally his first action after a cabinet meeting when he was sworn in. But there's been a commitment to industrial carbon pricing. So what that looks like exactly, we don't know. There has been concern on regulatory burden and making sure that things make sense. But there's not been a conversation from this government, this in public yet, about what the clean electricity regulations mean. And I mean, we spent a lot of time on this. I feel like, we've been very clear, I think, on our end that that the very strict version that was promulgated into regulation is hard for our members to, or impossible in some cases for our members to actually implement. But the actual emissions reductions that you get aren't really that big. And if you are focused on growth, if you are focused on making us competitive, and you want to see investment in clean energy, then reducing those barriers and making it possible to make investments will be key. And that's a conversation we're going to have relatively early on, and to figure out where there's opportunities. I think that there's a pragmatic path to find a more workable regulation. We talked about, without getting into the sort of weeds of it all, but allowing existing assets to run a little longer if stuff's already built, use it accordingly, and then being a little more flexible on what the standard is for new build power plants so that they could actually need it. And if you include that there will still be some form of industrial carbon pricing, there's still an incentive for clean in these sorts of pieces. But we'll see how that goes. That's in contrast with where the conservatives were, where they were very clear that they would repeal it. And so that's a conversation we're going to have. I think that the big thing on this for a lot of us is that how do we distinguish between the kinds of things that coming out of the last 10 years were a big problem, and how do we balance our time with what are the things that we need to solve so that we can keep delivering an expanded energy system for Canadians, and how do we make sure that the new things the government wants to talk to are including permitting, East-West Grid, all these things are moving forward as well, and how do we have that conversation and make sure that for us, it's a whole picture. It's not just what's in your current campaign book, but it's the rules that are in place right now that might be getting in the way of some of these things. And that's going to be a big focus for us the next, well, hopefully 2 months, but certainly between now and the end of the year.
Okay, Michael, I'm going to ask you to pull out your crystal ball for a couple of questions here. The first one, if as you look into your crystal ball, one of the next things that the government is going to have to do is assemble their new cabinet. One of the criticisms, of course, that was leveled at Prime Minister Carney when he became Prime Minister is that his cabinet looked very much like the cabinet under Trudeau. Is that likely to change? Are we going? Do you think we're going to see a substantially different cabinet, or are we going to see steady hand of a lot of people that are currently in the cabinet that will carry over into a new cabinet? What's your prediction on this one?
I think we're going to see some change. I think that what we'll see is, and overnight, there was an indication that we could see a cabinet in a couple of weeks, which would be the most aggressive timeline, I think, on some of these pieces. I think, particularly if you're not sure that you're not sure that you're going to see this government go all 4 years, that you're going to want to make as clear a break from the last government as you can, and that will probably mean changing some faces at the top. I think it might be that a bunch of very senior ministers will suddenly decide that I think if that had been a majority, let me say a different way, had there been
Ah,
180
yes.
seats, I think that it's very likely that there would have been a few ministers that decide that they would be quite interested in being ambassador to Switzerland or Japan or wherever. But where right now every single vote matters, you can't trust that a by-election will be helpful. Famously, the collapse of Justin Trudeau started when he lost a safe seat in Toronto in St. Paul's, and that was lost to the Conservatives. Leslie Church, the Liberal, won last night because it's a lot harder to really focus and flip those ridings when you're racing in 343 of them. So I think what we'll see is a shift. I think you're going to see some new faces, like as an example, the former chair of Hydro One, who worked with Mr. Carney back in his banking days, is I'm pretty sure now an MP. I'm not going to zoom all the way in, but that was in a pretty safe seat. I expect to see him in cabinet. I think some of the long in the tooth ministers from the last time will probably move to the back benches. But That's going to be a hard part. The other piece I think that'll be really interesting to watch as we move forward is how big is the cabinet? It was when Prime Minister Carney became prime minister, there was talk of a sub 20 person cabinet, and in the end we got 24 people, and that's because it's very hard to have a cabinet that is much smaller than that. So will it be a little bigger? Will it be perfectly gender balanced? There was a person off, and what will regionality look like? Last time there was chunks of places that didn't have seats, but now with a seat in Saskatchewan, which the government hasn't had in a long time, and with two, I think, seats in Alberta, at least as of right now, including one in Calgary, one in Edmonton. Will those people see their way into cabinet, and what does that look like? So these are the tests of a new approach to cabinet, where you have people that are very responsible for their things, they own it and move it forward, and you measure accordingly, and regionality doesn't matter so much. And then the sort of practical parts of politics, which is you got to hold where you're at, and this is a much tighter outcome, and a less certain outcome for long-term planning for the Liberals than a big majority government, or even 176 or 177 seats might have been.
Okay, one more question with respect to your crystal ball, and that is on interprovincial trade barriers that became a talking point for many of the leaders in the election. What's your take? Will we see significant action on reducing those interprovincial trade barriers? Is this likely going to be a key theme in the upcoming speech from the throne?
I think so. The government committed to getting rid of the federal part of interprovincial trade barriers by Canada Day. That's pretty aggressive. I think that every government has talked about getting rid of interprovincial trade barriers. If you go back, certainly in my time working, it's the last 25 years, identifying an issue as an issue and then moving forward. I think we'll see a substantial decrease in some of these things. I think the provinces are on side, which offers the opportunity. I think we'll see a big conversation on that. There, it gets to some meat and potatoes pieces pretty quickly. Some stuff is easy to manage, like there are apparently trucks entering Ontario have to put different warning signs on. That seems like a thing that's pretty easily solved. But when you get into labor requirements and some of the harder things, maybe that will be a challenge. But I think the focus is here, and particularly, given the Canada-US relationship, there's a greater recognition that there has to be more work within Canada to make sure that we're, not fighting amongst ourselves as we look to be competitive in the global marketplace. So I think we'll see a lot of that. I remain skeptical that the big stuff will fall. But I guess when I can order a bottle of BC wine to my house, just on the internet without having to go through the LCBO, then I'll believe it. But until that time, like the sort of the visible parts will be there, and some of the parochial parts of individual provinces on these things, I think will be harder to get rid of. But there is a pretty clear commitment from the federal government on this. As Francis, in a lot of our work, because electricity is provincial space, the feds convene and they lead. And on trade barriers, there will be a lot of convening on this over the next little while, for sure.
Okay, Michael, you can't get off a podcast without giving us a book recommendation, something to add to our Flux Capacitor book club. So, give me your recommendation. What's the
Well,
book that you're going to add to the reading list?
I'm going old school, and I'm picking George Grant's Lament for a Nation. I was at a used bookstore over the weekends, poking around, and it was there on the top. And I'm like, oh, I should. This feels like we are in the moment. As for those that haven't taken graduate level historiography classes, it's sort of a foundational piece of Canadian political history and thought. But in 1965, he was concerned that Canada as a country wasn't working anymore, and that we basically had subsumed ourselves to the Americans. At the time, it was the part of the impetus for this was accepting Bomarc missiles from John Diefenbaker and Lester Pearson that would be designed to shoot down Russian bombers coming over the poles. And here we are, 60 years later, talking about whether we can still exist as a country in the context of America. I think I picked at this when I was much younger in university, and I don't think I was much too concerned about whether Canada can still exist or not. But and I'm still not. The obviously we do, and I guess since 1965 we've had the 1972 series, we've had the Tragically Hip, and all those things. But here we are, and I think it's useful to remind ourselves that we've been through some of these challenges before. We've lamented some of these challenges before, and we move forward. And so I'm digging in and reminding myself that history repeats itself in a lot of ways, and we get through it because there's still a lot going on that we can tie ourselves together on. Even if, Francis, it's hard for me to get a bottle of BC wine or a Nova Scotia cider here in Ontario.
All right, Michael, that's a great addition to the book club. Appreciate that, and thanks for once again joining the pod. Appreciate your perspectives on this.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And for those that have been with the podcast since the beginning, and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Tune in for future episodes, which will include an episode about the Canada-U.S. electricity trade relationship. As I've said on previous podcasts, once we get some clarity about tariff actions by the administration in Washington, which now may evolve following our election here in Canada, please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen and let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me on Instagram as the Brad Bradley, on Blue Sky as at Francis Bradley, on LinkedIn, and through our website at electricity.ca. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 111. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Michael's recommendation, Lament for a Nation, The Defeat of Canadian Nationalism by George Grant. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.